Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is Wicked Problems. So a trillion is a big number, and 4 trillion, which is the predicted long-duration energy storage market, is the bigger number. So if you change a dollar into a second and try and sort of get an idea of how big a trillion seconds is around about 31,000 years. So 4 trillion is just a huge number that is going to enable the energy transition. We firmly believe that we have a solution that can address a significant part of that
heat. And I loved the quote you'd taken from some graffiti in Aberdeen saying, "God, please send us another oil boom. Next time, we won't push it up against the wall."
Britain had a fantastic opportunity in the North Sea and largely squandered it. It's not really about whether we should retain oil and gas. It's about how you make that transition and the phasing of it and when we bring in wind. And if you shut down one before you've got the other, as it were, then you're going to end up with an energy gap.
When we think of infrastructure like the cloud, you think of floaty things in the sky. You don't necessarily think of incredibly heavy industrial units. In terms of energy usage, actually denser than, say, aluminium smelting, so incredibly dense loads that would go onto the grid. The internet is an awesome thing, but it's also the biggest coal-powered machine in the world. And we think that's a bug in the system that we can fix.
Welcome back to Wicked Problems, Climate Tech Conversations. This is Theo Delavan. Richard Delavan has had to travel unexpectedly for a thing. And while he's loving the JetBlue flight to Boston, in flight somewhere south of Iceland isn't offering the best studio quality sound environment. Don't worry, we'll get through this together.
We've got a great Wicked Problems episode coming for you today. Data centers, particularly because of AI, are using more electricity than ever. And along with EVs and heat pumps are leading to the first big increase in electricity demand for many decades. Making sure those electrons aren't adding to the carbon emissions is a big problem. But are renewables ready to do the whole job? One of the people who spotted that problem before everybody else is Berlin-based Chris Adams, director at the non-profit Green Web Foundation. Richard used to work with him back in the day, and we've got a great interview with him. One of the solutions to the problem is longer duration energy storage, soaking up those electrons from wind and solar and storing them for longer than batteries, to be used when it's cloudy or calm. Re-energize is a pioneer in using a new twist on old technology, pumped hydro, enabling the same mechanism but without mountains. Your average hill will do. We speak with CEO David Crozer, but first, we had our roundtable discussion with Jonathan Leake of the Daily Telegraph and Ryan Chilcote, former CNN and Bloomberg Energy correspondent, recorded on April 11th, 2024. You'll be able to find the full interview with Stephen Crozer and Chris Adams at wickedproblems.earth, where you'll also be able to find our show notes, previous episodes, and become a paying supporter helping make Wicked Problems possible. But now, let's hand over to Richard Delavan and let him get into it.
We're back with Wicked Problems. I'm your host, Richard Delavan, and I'm so delighted we could be joined this week by the energy editor of the Daily Telegraph, Jonathan Leake, who's been filing copy like there's no tomorrow, been in the role now for a few months. Thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan.
I'm pleased to be here.
Also joined by a fan of the show, Ryan Chilcote, former OPEC reporter, former reporter with CNN, with Bloomberg, covering the former Soviet Union for a good long while there, and more recently working with folks in the critical minerals space in various capacities. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
Gents, we wanted to cover things that have been in the news for the last couple of weeks. And Jonathan, I wanted to start with your almost a long read, really, the piece about North Sea oil and time gone past. And I loved the quote you'd taken from some graffiti in Aberdeen saying, "God, please send us another oil boom. Next time, we won't pish it up against the wall." So tell us, get us into that story and that reporting, which seems to capture something about the zeitgeist here in the UK about this kind of almost nostalgia for North Sea oil. And your reporting, your headline says it's a disaster. The death of this industry is coming.
Yeah, so that quote you mentioned is a famous one. It's famous enough that it was made into a bumper sticker for taxis in Aberdeen at one time. And it encapsulated a feeling which has persisted over the decades, really, that Britain had a fantastic opportunity in the North Sea, where when in the 1970s it discovered some huge oil fields, and that it then took all the wealth and riches that came with that oil and gas and largely squandered it. And if you look back as on where the money went, we've had something like £400 billion in tax revenues over the years, and a whole lot more if you think about it in terms of the wages given to the workers and the taxes paid by workers, and also the income generated for companies and corporation taxes they paid. Good multiples there. And what is there left to show for it is the constant refrain. Now, that the money that went to the government seems to have largely been spent on supporting the economy on a kind of income basis. It was used for tax cuts and all kinds of other things that basically saw the then Conservative government through some difficult times with the unions. And the feeling, I think, that money has been wasted has persisted down the years, even till now. You could argue that if you look around Scotland, you've got a lot of companies and a lot of skilled people who are essentially a huge asset to the country and maybe will remain so for offshore wind development and such like. But in terms of things built and things done or funds kept in the way the Norwegians have, there's not much left. Right. So the Norwegians, by contrast, have I think it's a $1.3 trillion, you can correct me on that, fund for their country, which is, it equates to quarter of £1 million for each Norwegian citizen. Now, Norway's a lot less populous than the UK, so it's not fair to make a direct comparison. You can still argue very much that the forward thinking of the Norwegian government is a great contrast to what British.
I think that I'm right in saying that fund owns about 3% of all the public equities on the planet, which is quite something. And they certainly have fingers in it in so many pies that they have this incredible outsized influence on public markets as a result. Although, you know, some very interesting policies about what they actually do with that influence. So, Jonathan, I mean, are we experiencing a kind of nostalgia at the moment, this kind of recurring feeling that, yeah, we blew it, but is there kind of a feeling that maybe we could still do it again, we could do some more of it, and a failure to see that maybe that ship has literally sailed?
So nostalgia, a bit of nostalgia, but I think there's more a sense of anxiety as well, because if you go to the communities in northeastern Scotland, so around Aberdeen, but across really much of Scotland, because a lot of the workers are spread across there, and also into England. I mean, there's even a cluster of oil companies around Guildford in Surrey, located there because of the proximity to Heathrow, and others all across East Anglia. There's a sense of anxiety over the, imminent, but sort of within the next 2 decades, if that's imminent, shutting down of the North Sea. If you look at what's happening in the North Sea, you've essentially got, I think, something like 35 billion cubic meters of gas coming ashore now, which is about half what it was 20 years ago. And I think you've got roughly 40 million tons of oil, which is not coming ashore. It's actually being exported because we've shut so many refineries. And again, that's about a third of what we had 20 years ago. And the decline across the two fuels, oil and gas, is roughly, it's at least 6% a year, but it seems to be accelerating because of the various government policies around windfall taxes and so on. So what you're looking at is a really quite rapid shutdown of oil and gas. And that's generating, yes, nostalgia. I would say also what's a stronger emotion is anxiety and uncertainty, which is what's going to come next. And just to give you one stark statistic, we've got something like 284 oil and gas fields at the moment. And as of now, about 180 are predicted to close by 2030. So our gas supplies, which are roughly, we're supplying roughly, I think, 40 to 50% of our needs at the moment, are predicted to go down to 20% by 2030. For oil, this will probably keep on going a bit longer. But again, oil doesn't really do that much for our national security because we don't have the refineries. So it all goes to places like Rotterdam and even China. I mean, it's a bit of a shock to think there's something like, I think it's at one stage, 20% of the UK's crude oil was going straight to China. I think it's gone down a bit now to maybe 10 or 15, but you can see that it was generating tax, but it wasn't generating that much in the way of extra revenues.
Ryan, as a fellow Yank native, we would have grown up being familiar with the use of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in the States. Any thoughts, Ryan?
Yeah.
On your end, in terms of what implications we think this shutting down of this industry and the implications of the anxiety that come from that. We see this playing out in lots of other places. What's your view about what we should think about as these communities and these people are anxious about this? Yeah.
I mean, there's no way I can speak anywhere nearly as eloquently as Jonathan just did about the situation in the UK. I've been to Aberdeen. I've seen outside of Aberdeen some of the communities and the sort of, I guess, lack of industrial growth now that's taking place in those places. I mean, I would just say, and what's interesting, I think, that you were talking about there, Jonathan, is if you think about internationally, you mentioned Norway, but oil and gas are a big factor of ensuring the welfare of a lot of countries. But if you think about Russia, you know, with like 10 million barrels a day, Russia is able to effectively, even with the cap, pretty comfortably keep its economy going, fund the war, and maintain a pretty large degree of economic autonomy or natural resource autonomy in a period where it's pretty obviously been isolated as the most sanctioned country in the history of the world. You think about the United States, I don't know where we are right now, but more than 10 million barrels a day in oil and gas, especially, and all of the sort of renaissance of oil and gas in the United States, huge part of the economic growth that's taking place there. Saudi Arabia obviously is benefiting hugely and has been. So yeah, it's a factor. I mean, the only thing I thought your fantastic article, I just thought, and I appreciate it. I was reading it earlier. I just feel like the focus now has to be, I'm no policymaker, but if you're looking at, well, what does the UK do with that anxiety now and move forward? Surely it must be the new energy, the energy revolution, right? Because even if the UK started to try and restore some of that sort of prowess it had in the energy markets, it can only go so far. I mean, even in its heyday, like the UK produced, what, 500,000 barrels of oil a day, or less than a million in any case, right? Which in a market where there's 100 million sort of swashing around, it's not going to make a huge dent. I mean, I would have thought that in terms of energy and economic security for the UK, the huge priority right now has to be on fashioning a role for it in the future in the critical mineral space and in the new energy space.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I would say, so the backdrop to all this is the climate crisis. And we should a mistake that climate change is a global and very serious issue, and it has to be tackled. So once you accept that, then the debate around oil and gas and wind and all other energies, it's not really about whether you should retain oil and gas or whether you should mix. It's about how you make that transition and the phasing of it. So in the UK, there's a great commitment to move away from oil and gas towards some lower carbon energies. But one of the problems, so then you have to decide, how do we get rid of the oil and gas, and when do we bring in wind? And if you shut down one before you've got the other, as it were, then you're going to end up with an energy gap. But you're also going to end up with a gap in finance and in workers. So in Scotland, there's a very particular problem, which is the rate at which the oil and gas industry is closing down is creating a gap around the late 2020s. So there, for a period, there won't be enough work to keep that workforce going as the to take advantage of the build-up of the renewables industry. And that's not really been thought through by government. So there's got to be a transition, but there's got to be, it's got to be a transition that's planned and orderly. Otherwise, you're going to get into phases where you lose your workers or you lose your technologies. And the risk to Britain at the moment is that it loses its workers because there isn't enough, or there isn't enough work being generated in building and installing turbines to take all the people who've been in oil and gas or those who are coming up or as apprentices or whatever in the numbers required. So they'll drift away. And the risk is, the risk for Britain is that its skilled offshore and onshore engineering workforce dissipates before the renewable boom, if you like, takes off. And I think that's the kind of subtle shades of grey dilemma and problem that our politicians haven't even understood, let alone started dealing with.
No, I think that's a good point, and something that I think we'll continue to read your coverage on that, Jonathan, to make sure you're keeping people honest about all the different shades of grey, as you say. So, Ryan, one of the other things we wanted to talk about was this spate of alliances on some of the things we're taking out of the ground that are, again, in some visions of the future, will replace a lot of the kind of hydrocarbons, and so by battery minerals in particular. We've seen a couple of different international agreements that seem like they've come close to coming together over the last couple of weeks. What's been going on?
Yeah, so the United States and the European Union have been trying to reach a deal that would effectively foster the exchange and trade of critical minerals and processing of critical minerals in a kind of a trade between the United States and the EU. Uh-huh. And they don't seem to be getting there. And there's this sense that it's not going as fast as they would like. And maybe they're looking, you know, staring down the barrel of a gun in the sense that, you know, in the United States, at least there are elections in November. No one knows what's going to happen with those elections. If Donald Trump, for example, becomes president of the United States again, what does that mean for, I would say, everything when it comes to the US and the EU, let alone something as obscure for perhaps as critical minerals in the big picture? The EU has been working on a deal. There's a little bit more optimism on that front with Australia to do much the same. Mm. And they're looking to basically sign that deal next year. And so it's just interesting. Basically, the other side of both of those deals, the US and the European Union trying to do a deal and the EU and Australia, is these growing alliances of, let's say, sort of Western countries or U.S. affiliated countries, or perhaps if we get more specific, IRA sort of adjacent or aligned countries that want in on the United States Inflation Reduction Act and that economy that it's creating an opportunity, and those that aren't. And I don't even know how you describe those countries anymore, but we definitely have this new divide. I don't know what you call it. It's not as simple as it was back in Soviet versus U.S. day. Mm-hmm. I think this term global South, though we're not just talking about the South, so that's not incredibly helpful,
right,
is useful. But clearly on the other side of the trade, on the outside of this camp, and all of these alliances are directed against China.
Right.
And it's interesting developments to watch.
From having pretty much heading towards zero to now being, again, on par with Saudi. But when you look at the concentration of battery minerals, copper, lithium, cobalt, particularly the refining aspect of it, never mind where it's sourced, like the bar charts or the pie charts are insanely different. Like you have this aggregation for, you know, oil production, but China is, I was watching Rystad Energy's seminar on this yesterday, it's 85% plus as opposed to 13% for Saudi when it comes to oil production. So, I mean, are these alliances something that, do we think that that Western, you know, countries are doing enough on this? Should they be doing more? How concerned should we be about this? Or are people just overplaying this in order to be able to stoke up populist fears of the red menace from China?
It always comes back to China in these discussions, doesn't it? I think when it comes down to critical minerals, we're at a strange stage where no one quite knows. When I say no one, I mean the public and politicians don't really understand what the debate's even about. And that's because it's talked about in slightly arcane terms. For example, we talk about critical minerals or rare earth minerals or lithium, and it doesn't resonate. And therefore, it doesn't become political and doesn't feel like it matters in elections and the political discussions. If you turn that round and you talk about iPhones or EVs or the products that we're used to using every day, and what is monopolies by China, if that's true, or what the shortage is, or what, for example, the abuse of weak countries like DRC, or the exploitation of its minerals, or until you turn that into something people understand, like what it means for your life and your products, you won't get that political attention. So, and at the moment, these sorts of issues tend to follow an arc. So you get the beginnings of an issue like this where people are discussing it in kind of niche circles like ours right now. But over time, the issues become familiar and they grow and they become politically resonant. And I think this is an issue which is the beginning of that arc. But in coming years, we're going to see it growing and growing, especially when more people are driving EVs, for example, or using consumer products that contain these various minerals, and especially when they're paying more for them. So it's one of those issues that you could argue that China saw it a long time ago. I can remember attending conferences 10 or 15 years ago where I went to the Lindau conference, which is a conference for Nobel laureates, about 10 or 15 years ago. They were discussing exactly this and how China had basically been thinking far ahead of its time and still is. Maybe we're catching up now. And that catching up will generate political tension and that will feed its way into the media and into the public mind.
Right.
But I think we're at the beginning of this, and it's something we're going to see probably spreading over decades, not just years.
And I think, you know, that brings us to our final topic. I'm conscious of time, and I know, Jonathan, you probably have some things to file this evening. So very grateful in particular to both of you, but particularly to Jonathan for taking the time. I also wanted, obviously for the week that's in it, we had what seems to be an historic decision, you know, by the European Court of Human Rights, which has been in the news here in the UK for all sorts of other reasons. But this ruling this week seems to have given, how shall we say, a completely new injection of adrenaline, testosterone, pick your chemical, to be able to actually take this up to another level about why the EC and the climate have come together as being a potent issue that maybe we may be hearing more about. So, Jonathan, what was that? And tell us about some of the coverage of the reactions that you were covering.
Yeah, the European Court of Human Rights is in the news in general in the UK because of an entirely separate issue, which is immigration, and in particular the repatriation of immigrants to the UK back to their countries or to Rwanda. Rwanda is a very particular issue, and this has led to a political backlash from Conservative Party, who are furious that the ECHR has stopped the UK from sending illegal immigrants or illegal asylum seekers to Rwanda. So that's the backdrop. The case that came up this week was entirely separate, and it involves three separate cases which have been essentially brought together into one because they all involve the same issues. And the argument was that by permitting climate change, or at least by not taking sufficient action against the causes of climate change, various governments across Europe, I think about 30, more than 30 of them, were infringing the human rights of their citizens. So that was the backdrop. Two of the cases failed because they looked actually a bit amateurish to me. They hadn't exhausted the legal possibilities in their own countries, which is the basic.
And these were the Portuguese teenagers who were bringing that case, right?
Yeah. There's a group of ladies from Switzerland, yes, who said their rights have been infringed by the lack of action by the Swiss government. And they succeeded.
Yeah.
And that particular ruling is now expected to find its way into rulings all over Europe, I suppose, but also to influence court rulings in countries all around the world. Mm. Now, I'm just going to divulge for one second and say the European Court of Human Rights is a partly British creation dating back some years, and it has passed many judgments that have had profound effects across Europe. Just being personal, it was the European Court of Human Rights effectively banned the physical punishment of people, of kids in British schools. I was at a school which used that kind of punishment, and I can tell you it made a big difference. And it's essentially improved the lives of people, refugees, whoever, across Europe for many years. And so the political attacks on it by certain parts of the UK Conservative Party, they're really misplaced. And I think what the senior figures of the party know that, because essentially right now the Chancellor and others are blocking attempts to remove the UK from the European Court of Human Rights. But the latest ruling, whatever Britain's status within the ECHR, will resonate into what happens across Europe and in Britain. So it's an important ruling, and it adds to the pressure on governments to react, basically, and to do what, and to carry out their promises, which on climate have been notable for not being met.
Do you think that, I mean, in decades to come, I mean, again, so President Schäfer O'Leary delivered this verdict on the climate grannies in Switzerland, I think average aged 73, all female, 2,000 kind of members of this group, who said and were judged to be correct by the court that their particular vulnerability to the effects of climate change because of extreme heat events, because of other things, gave them standing to be able to make this claim. If this does result, as some people suggest, in a spate of other litigation by citizens, by groups, against national governments who are subject to the jurisdiction of the ECHR, do you think that both critics and fans of the decision are correct? And like 20 years from now, we'll be looking back going, that was a moment where the legal landscape changed rather dramatically. As you say, it could have global implications, but particularly here in the European space.
So there's been quite a lot of, using the law to try to impact climate policy has become a tactic of a lot of NGOs. And this is an example of it, as opposed to being sort of the key example. All of them having an effect. There's a case going on in Holland, I think, at the moment against Shell. Mm-hmm. And that's an appeal by Shell because Shell lost its case.
Yep.
So this is just, it's another manifestation of a tactic that NGOs are using quite successfully. I think in America, there's any number of cases against some of the oil companies and the pressure is growing. But as a standout case, yeah, it probably is. But we'll have to see.
Hmm. I mean, I'll give you a tip for a paper read by avidly by many members of the cabinet, but there's a bill in Vermont, actually, which will be the first of its kind. If it goes through, we'll be interviewing actually the dean of the Vermont Law School that helped to actually put this through. It's coming to a final vote. And they're going to basically legislate to hold oil companies accountable directly for damages as a result of extreme weather events due to climate change, which will be, we'll see what happens in terms of federal review of that law if it comes to actually be signed. But it would be a first of its kind of anywhere in the world. So there you go. That's my little gift to you, Jonathan. But Ryan, I mean, do you think that we're likely, Jonathan's point, that we're seeing a lot of this tactic? Do we think that's a good thing? Do we think it's a bad thing? Do we think that the political process has stalled and now we're seeing this activism on the judicial front be something that is this going to be just more noise in the culture war, or do we think this will actually move the needle?
I mean, the obvious issue here is when you have local action, let's say in this case in the European Union affecting the UK, is that climate change and the climate crisis, a global problem, local action that will not necessarily be reflected globally, right? Not to belittle the 2,000 grannies in Switzerland, but 2,000 grannies in Russia, for example, will not be getting such a similar verdict in Russia or in China or in huge parts of the world. So it creates this situation where you have this uneven and fragmented regulatory framework where in some countries, big companies can face massive risks now, right? I mean, obviously, Switzerland is going to look differently now at how it pursues its targets, knowing the fact that, and look at how it pursues regulation of companies, and you and I have talked about this, knowing that it can get spanked by the European Court for Human Rights. So I just think it's a fascinating issue, and it's going to be manifest itself in these interesting ways. You mentioned Vermont, the Switzerland. It just makes me think about how we had this huge push to for divestment in public companies, in oil and gas companies. And a lot of people, that's been going on for, what, 5 years now, universities, pensions being basically compelled to exit supporting their investment in oil and gas companies. And who's benefited? Well, national oil companies and private oil companies that don't face the same constraints and actually are able to come in and buy into these companies as a result, because they're not under the same. It's all good. I guess, obviously, people using the courts to try and find ways to look after their welfare and their rights, but it's going to be a very complicated, the way this develops is going to be very complicated and not necessarily always good and the way people wanted things to happen.
Hey, here are some ads to help pay the bill.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
If you'd prefer a version without ads, subscribe to our member feed at wickedproblems.earth. A monthly subscription is cheaper than buying us a pint. This is an abridged edition of our interview with Chris Adams, director of the Green Web Foundation. If you'd like to hear the full interview, subscribe at wickedproblems.earth, and the full interview will arrive like magic in your inbox very soon.
And I'm delighted to be joined by Mr. Chris Adams, renowned expert in sustainable digital infrastructure. Good morning, Chris, from Berlin.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me. And lovely to speak to you again after so long.
You're speaking to us from Berlin, where you're working with the Green Web Foundation.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about how you wound up working specifically in this space.
The short version is maybe 10 to 15 years of wacky climate and open data startups. And I learned loads of stuff, which is really, really helpful for understanding where we are now, even how we got into this mess.
Particularly since the advent of smartphones, there are 5 billion internet users will now have come to accept as being, you know, a boring everyday part of life. Mm-hmm. And yet it's something that has surprisingly taken up only a very small amount of electricity demand in the world. But it's something that you're keeping an eye on for some time, which is why the foundation was a good fit for you. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I got involved in this was because, well, you've got to think about it. The electricity has to come from somewhere when you're using digital services. My life is improved by the internet. But when I kind of graduated, I was like, well, I should be responsible about this in the same way that I should be responsible about other fields. So I should kind of think where is the power coming from, or what can you do to reduce the avoidable harm for this? And that was kind of where I was initially kind of started approaching this. And then as we ended up using more and more in the way of digital to kind of enable various other parts of our lives, the kind of amount of usage has basically skyrocketed. And it's useful to bear in mind that this has been incredibly useful. Like, can you imagine what the pandemic experience would have been like without access to all the services we had, right? It would have been untenable. But at the same time, and what we've seen is that we've seen a kind of growth, a massive growth in use with a smaller growth in the actual energy usage. But because it's just at such a massive scale, that ends up being something in the region of honestly comparable to significant economies, like between 1-2% of all electricity use,
right,
are the figures people use, and corresponding figures for carbon emissions as well, depending on how you measure it. So that's like, that's non-zero. That's double the UK, size of Germany, maybe the size of Canada kind of stuff.
I know a little bit about this stuff, because it was a dangerous thing. We spoke to the chief technology officer from Hitachi Energy a couple of weeks ago, as we're coming out of COP28, people talking about this need for trebling renewables. You know, but one of the things that seems to be changing, that for 20 years, we've had electricity utilities around the world have had basically almost flat demand. And as you're saying,
flat demand, absolutely.
We've had this basically, you know, data centers have more and more efficient at their energy usage in terms and other commodities in terms of what they're, how they're actually producing the services that data centers provide, the digital infrastructure for the internet services that we use. But we're at an inflection point, and people can now see this, the graphs kind of hockey sticking.
This is actually just data center use, because the thing that a lot of us aren't really that aware of is, like, when we think of infrastructure like the cloud, you think of floaty things in the sky. You don't necessarily think of 50 or 100 megawatt facilities the size of, you know, football pitches, which are essentially incredibly heavy industrial units, which are, in terms of energy usage per square foot, they're actually denser than, say, aluminium smelting and stuff like that. So incredibly dense loads that would go onto the grid. And we have seen massive increases in efficiency over the last, say, decade and a half, I suppose. But the flip side of that is that that has increased the amount of usage that has been at our fingertips. So there's a term called Jevons paradox, or if you want to be really, really posh, the Kazum-Brooks postulate, right? Which basically says, as things become more accessible, you end up using them more. And this is a phenomenon we've seen for like more than around 200 years of history. Like, this is initially people first saw this when we started looking at the use of coal in steam engines, and realizing that by making steam engines more efficient, we ended up using more coal, basically.
Right.
Essentially, that's kind of what we have now in lots and lots of places. So for kind of just to give you some kind of sense of context, the use by data centers is comparable to cities now. So that's around 20%. In Denmark, you also see similar figures for this. In America, I believe Silicon Valley Power, which is one of the municipal electricity providers, in their most recent kind of their plan for the next 10 years, they've said our biggest load, our biggest source of energy usage is not going to be cars. It's going to be data centers. And we're expecting that to double. And this is what we're going to have. This is what we're going to have to double the amount of electricity, the amount of generation to meet this load growth. So it's non-trivial, to put it mildly, right now.
I remember, 17 years ago, writing about this and how data centers, and when I was working in Ireland as a journalist, and how, you know, the data centers that were coming on stream were going to have the same power requirements as Dublin Airport.
Yeah.
Like huge figures. And now this hockey stick seeing from generative AI and where we expect to go.
When you look at large companies, so Google, basically say around 15% of our demand is now servicing AI workloads, right? So 15%, and like they use maybe what, 2 terawatt hours per year. So that's like a significant amount there. And you've seen various other companies also think about this. Like, although the general word that you'll hear is people won't talk about this necessarily publicly, but it's an extremely fast growing use. It's actually, in my view, the lack of transparency is a real barrier to policymaking right now, because while we have seen essentially we've been able to kind of keep up or possibly beat or keep up with Jevons paradox, but now that we have this new load, we do need to actually have a really serious discussion about, okay, well, how are we meeting this? And if we're going to be creating all this demand for energy, how do we actually maintain our climate goals? Or how do we ensure that this is decarbonized energy in the same way you might talk about how we talk about hydrogen having to be decarbonized to avoid having all these unintended effects to kind of make things worse, basically.
Right. I mean, we could go all day on hydrogen, but one of the core missions of the Green Web Foundation is to alert people to the fact that, you know, even though we don't think of it because it's just electrons powering our devices, that electrons are currently generated in dirty ways, more or less dirty, depending on what part of the world you're sitting in and where those electrons are generated.
Yeah, sure. So we care about a just and sustainable internet. That sounds very kind of lofty, but more concretely, that kind of manifests in the need for an entirely fossil-free internet. Because the internet primarily runs on the same grid as the rest of the kind of energy system, that means we primarily run on fossil fuel. So the internet is an awesome thing, but it's also the biggest coal-powered machine in the world. And we think that's a bug in the system that we can fix, because in many cases, I think a fossil-free internet is plausible, it's necessary, it's desirable. And in many ways, we have seen signs that there are various companies who are being able to move at a speed to help kind of bend some of this curve. So when I've spoken about some of the large technology firms just now, for example, the corporate buyers of renewable energy have been the largest single private purchaser of renewable energy over the last few years. But one of the reasons that they've done that is because it makes so much economic sense for them. And this is actually something, this makes me think that, yes, we probably can get there and we can move quickly enough to basically decarbonize this sector, which would, through things like learning rates, would make it accessible, make other sectors easier to decarbonize too in the same way. And like we have seen signs of this. So I think this is something that we do. We build various tools to make this easier for people to kind of be aware of.
So yeah, do, because I think, yeah, it's important just to dwell on this for a second. I mean, it's something that... many people listening to this podcast would be aware of power purchase agreements and the fact that, you know, Google is able to get a cost per kilowatt hour that is much, much less than you or me, generally speaking, if we're just buying from the grid. Although there are some disruptors like Ripple Energy here in the UK that seem to be doing some really interesting stuff about trying to take that model and apply it to a kind of co-op. So tell us about the tools that you guys have helped to develop for, you know, companies are looking to, you know, for these climate goals to be aligned with net zero, or indeed just because they're like, hey, I'd like that kind of Google rate. How do I get that?
I think the thing that we're probably best known for, or have been for the last 10 years, is basically just providing some checking tools. So if you are building digital services, we provide a series of checkers and APIs, which are essentially like things which allow you to integrate into other tools to check if any domain, any website is running on renewable energy. So if you have a supplier in your supply chain, you can say, are they moving as fast as you want to be moving as fast? And basically, you check a website, we will basically show you all the information that we can find about that organization. And we do this because, or we can do this because, there are more websites than there are data centers in the world. So if you basically look up maybe, say, richarddelavan.com, for example, or wickedproblems.uk, we can trace it to a particular data center. We can then get in touch with the data center or make it easy for them to share, disclose information with us, basically saying, can you provide the evidence that you have taken steps to at least match the power you're using with generation? If we can find that, we basically mark it as green and we show the evidence that we do actually have for that. If it's not the case, we provide tools to make it easy to ask people to make that change. We also do a bit of guidance for people, for firms who are looking to understand some of the risk in their own kind of portfolio of services they use themselves and what some of the model language might actually be to ask for this. And we also do bits of work like policy, so speaking to policymakers about some of the drivers here. This whole idea about, say, large firms having totally different economics to small firms is something that most policymakers aren't so aware of. So in many cases, while we have various kinds of policy to kind of help move an internet to a kind of greener state, it does tend to come at the cost of a diverse internet. So, for example, Google, we spoke about just now, over the last 10 years, where most people might be spending 40 to 50 US dollars per megawatt hour, for example, Google might be paying half of that because they've been able to access all kinds of subsidies that are basically made available to large industrial users. This is the thing, like that is good for a transition. That kind of does mean that we end up with a consolidation amongst a number of large companies who, while might be moving quite quickly in terms of decarbonizing their own supply, aren't necessarily doing the work they should be doing in other places. So if you go on YouTube, for example, and or various other kind of social media tools, there's still plenty of climate disinformation and misinformation.
Right.
And even when companies have said, we're not going to allow people to collect money from this, whether they follow through with like demonetization of like disinformation and so on. There's some really interesting work from the Campaign Against Climate Disinformation. I believe I'll share the link to them, who have basically been showing, okay, this is how the large social media companies we're familiar with and how they're accepting loads of money from people who are trying to slow down the transition rather than speed up the transition. And this is problematic because speed is justice, basically. We do need to move quickly on this.
Wildly. In thinking about tech actors, I'm still trying to figure out how to decode, right? So you've got Google, which has, you know, done really interesting work over the last 4 years in, you know, kind of moving, I think you've spoken about this, the computational work around the world in order to have it match.
Through time and space. Yeah.
Through time and space and to different data centers so that they can try to chase the greenest electrons to run you know, the data centers. And that's interesting. But of course, if you're a first mover, you get to do that. If you're a last mover, it becomes harder when Google's already done it. Those green electrons become more scarce. But other players spent money to lobby in California against SB 253, which is the disclosure requirements for Scope 3. So, you know, a lot of people in front of the camera saying, we're all for this transition. We're going as quickly as possible. We're doing all these great tools. But behind the camera, you know, we have some of them are a little more of a mixed record. So you guys seem to be, you know, you seem to be personally thinking about that a lot as well.
Yeah, I kind of feel like this comes down to governance at some level and what you incentivize, right? There's a company which has a mission, which is to collect and categorize all the world's information and make it universally accessible. Right, that sounds really lofty and really great. But really, the mission of the company is to return as much value to shareholders as possible. And secondly, categorize and make all the information accessible. And like one of these takes priority over the other. And this is what you see coming up again and again. When you see these things in alignment, then it makes sense. Like, say, renewables, for example. The reason large companies end up making big noises about decarbonizing their infrastructure is because economically it makes just so much sense. It's by far the cheapest way to do this right now. It's important to be able to share multiple ideas and also in many ways not attribute a kind of value judgment to a person, to a company. Just because someone is a corporate person doesn't mean that they act like human people or anything like that. And I think this is one of the problems coming up again and again and again, because we're incentivizing organizations list act like sociopaths. And until we have a way to actually incentivize people to act somewhat differently or in a more kind of pro-social fashion, you'll see this coming up again and again and again.
Now we're delighted to bring you the abridged version of our interview with Stephen Crozer of Reenergize about their high-density pumped hydro solution that might just be the energy storage solution that people have been waiting for. Here's our conversation.
Welcome to Wicked Problems. Stephen Crozer from Reenergize, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What is Reenergize and what are you guys doing?
Okay. Reenergize is a long duration energy storage solution. And so our ambition and our aim, and we think we can achieve it, is to help solve the transition to zero carbon energy systems, or net zero, as some people call it. So we've recognized for a while now that the world is transitioning to more and more renewable energy. And that is going to come in the form of principally solar and wind power, but there will be some biomass and other deep geothermal and other forms of generation. But what you principally find with the solutions, and not all solutions, but the bulk of the solutions that are going to exist in the energy system of the future, is there's an awful lot of intermittency in the supply of the generation. And so wind, when you look at that, it has a roughly a twice weekly cycle of going through highs and lows, and then solar has obviously a daily cycle. And so how do you match that intermittent supply with the variable demand that consumers have? And so you tend to, with consumers, you have a morning peak and then it goes down slightly during the day, and then there's an evening peak again, and then it drops off overnight, as you would expect. So you have all this variability on the system, and sometimes with some spikes in generation or some real low points in, but you've got to balance the two. And that's where long duration energy storage comes in. And that's what we're basically looking to do. And so you can't deploy huge amounts of intermittent renewables without some form of energy storage, without a form of flexibility that is replacing gas peaking plants, which is the primary source of flexibility on the grids. And so that's what we're aimed to do.
Okay. So There are a couple of different classes of energy storage, right? So our listeners will be familiar with this. Essentially, you've got
short duration storage, which lithium ion batteries have actually done a lot of that work over the last few years. And the long duration energy storage category, I suppose the definition is a bit woolly at the moment, in the sense that the LDS Council calls it 100 hours or above in terms of that. And we have people talking about seasonal storage to compensate for Dunkelflaute events in various parts of the world. So where do you guys fit into that?
Yeah, there are a number of solutions and there are a number of use cases. And also it's somewhat arbitrary, the definitions that people use, and it depends on your use case. So if you're in a system that's entirely dominated by solar and you have good solar radiation all through the year, you probably will never need 100 hours of storage because it's just too predictable. Maybe you'll have a day where something happens and you really get a lot less than you expect, but it's literally only a day. The long duration for a country like Chile might well be 20 hours and is considered a long duration. Well, if you're a country more like the UK, where you have this sort of much more variability because we're dominated by wind, then long duration might be 30 hours. So I think there's often a use case definition, which is somewhat missed by those who are discussing it. But the way we like to think about it is there's a short duration use case, which could be anything from flywheels, lithium ion batteries, supercapacitors, which have got this sort of seconds to couple of hours use case, maybe a bit longer in the case of lithium ion batteries. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have got the interseasonal storage, which is probably going to be sort of green hydrogen or something like that, which is really looking at stuff over very, very long time scales, months possibly even longer.
Sure.
And then you've got what we sometimes refer to as medium duration energy storage, which is probably where we sit. So we're really looking at the 4 to 16 hours, maybe 20 hours in such a circumstance of energy storage. The role of that type of energy storage is to do the heavy lifting in terms of the day in, day out cycling of energy. So there's various analysts who are looking at this particular problem, and what you tend to be coming out of this analysis of the different use cases is that shorter duration up to around 4 hours probably do something like 15% of the energy volumes in a market over a year.
Right.
And then that long duration, which is probably above 24 hours in reality, all the way to interseasonal storage, that's doing another 15% of the total energy volumes. And what's sitting between the 4 and the 20 hours is medium duration energy storage, but it's actually the storage that is doing the heavy lifting in terms of day in, day out, moving of huge volumes of energy. And that's where we sit. So it's the volume part of the market.
Right.
The short duration stuff is a volume market, but in a different way. It's more about providing ancillary services. So it is being used an awful lot. So it's a volume in terms of its use case.
Right.
But in terms of energy volumes on the grid, it's doing much less.
So that's super helpful. So basically, just if I can recap, tell me where I'm wrong here, Stephen. But basically, so batteries, in the most use cases right now, we're providing ancillary services, short-term, basically, in some cases, to replace peaking plants, but in some of the things. We've got the Dunkelflaute storage over here, where we're talking about days, months, whatever. And then you guys are in this middle piece. So that's great to know. And then basically, you guys are a flavor, I suppose, of pumped hydro. And listeners will know that in my dim and distant dark past, I've worked for people like Baker Hughes and various other kind of energy companies. And so whenever I've had a chance to ask some of their boffins, let's say, about what kind of long duration or medium duration storage medium has a future, and almost all of them to a person would say, yeah, look, I mean, the return round-trip efficiency for pumped hydro is just 80-odd, close to 90%. So if you do anything else, you really need a good reason. So where do you guys sit vis-a-vis pumped hydro? And tell me about all the ways you're different from traditional pumped hydro, sorry.
So it's probably worth just taking a step back and talking a little bit about where we came from as a business, because it is so directly related to the pumped hydro use case. So myself and colleagues, we were at energy conferences a few years back, and everyone was talking about the transition, intermittency, need for energy storage. And then everyone to a person was saying the solution are batteries. Nothing was even mentioned, not even pumped hydro. And we knew that at the time, if you measured by power, pumped hydro represented 95% of the world's energy storage, just measured by power. If measured by energy, so duration, is that then it's was over 99%, and it still is, of the total energy stored. And the question then came, why, when you have this solution that has been around for the best part of 100 years, been operating successfully for many decades, why are everyone on these conferences talking about a different solution? It doesn't make any sense. It does at certain use cases, this ultra hot, fast ability to react with lithium ion batteries and flywheels. So there are reasons why people were talking about it. But in terms of energy storage, so true capacity, no one was talking about pumped hydro. So we decided to ask ourselves the question, why is that? And there are a whole host of reasons, but it's actually primarily to do the time it takes to get the planning consents, the various consents, and then to build a project, often measured in about 2 decades. So you have these huge projects. And then with traditional pumped hydro, the incentive is to look for a great site. And then once you've found a good site, you maximize the scale of the project, which makes them longer to consent and harder to consent and longer to construct. You then sort of force yourself into this 2-decade type time periods for traditional pumped hydro. And that sort of raises 2 challenges. One, it's not really a great solution for the climate emergency because you're not really getting stuff online until the 2040s, 2050s. So you have a huge period where you really should be acting.
Right.
But also it means that every project is one-off. They're all purpose designed. It means that you can't get commoditization and the economies of scale particularly easily. And then the third thing is, it's very difficult to finance them because when you've got a 20-year window between thinking about a project and getting revenues from it, to get the development finance and then the construction finance is almost impossible because you can't predict what the revenues are going to be. So you can't show your financial model with enough certainty to get the debt. So it becomes a challenging solution, particularly for the climate emergency, unless you've got some sort of government-backed project. So you do see them getting built in various places because there's China, because there's significant government backing in India, but because for the same reasons. And that's great. We think it's a great solution. And it will address part of the climate emergency, but maybe 10% by 2050. There's still another 90% that still needs to be addressed, and you need solutions to address that. No one single solution can scale that sort of speed to do it. Coming to your question on how are we the same and how are we different? So we are fundamentally the same, whereby there's a lower reservoir. For us, it's in storage tanks. There's pipes connecting the from the lower to the upper reservoir. There's a powerhouse next to the lower reservoir, or storage tanks in our case. And fundamentally, when energy is abundant, you pump the water, or in our case, our high-density fluid, up the mountain, or in our case, the hill. And then when energy is scarcer, you release it and regenerate it through a turbine back to the grid. As you said, traditional pumped hydro, modern plants are operating at an excess of 80% round-trip efficiency. We expect to be the same. There's no fundamental physics why we shouldn't be achieving the same sort of levels around the efficiencies. And then what are we doing that is different? So again, taking a step back, when we were looking at traditional pumped hydro, this project that take too long to consent and construct, so clearly rather than be 20 years, you probably want to be less than 4. You want projects that you can consent and construct in less than 4 years from beginning to operation on it, because that's commensurate with battery storage projects, wind projects, solar projects.
And if we could pause you there for a second, Stephen. So why is it shorter? Because I think this is really an important question to get consent and do something. I think I know the answer, but I want to hear like from you.
What we've done is rather than using water, we've introduced a fluid that is 2.5 times denser than water. So this is more than the density of concrete. So a concrete block would float. So it's a high density, low viscosity, highly stable fluid. What that increase in density enables us to do is one of two things. You can either lower the vertical elevation that you need proportional to increase in density. So we get the same performance at only 40% of the height as a water project. So suddenly there's orders of magnitude more siting opportunities because we get the same performance at 200 meters as you would with a water project of 500 meters. So we're looking for hills rather than mountains. The second thing that the increase in density does is you can reduce the volumetric size of your project, which is not only the storage tanks, but also the pipes, the valves, the turbo machinery. It all gets smaller volumetrically. And that means that as a project gets smaller, it's less construction work, becomes quicker to build. So the projects are less visual impact. Right. You have more siting opportunities because of the lower elevation. So you can be more selective about where you want to put them. You can be away from remote, pristine, mountainous areas. You can be on any hill next to an industrial plant, for example. So because of the greater number of opportunities, then consenting should become easier and then construction should be quicker.
Right.
And then the third part of that equation is rather than looking for projects that are half a gigawatt in size, and it doesn't matter whether you build half a gigawatt of wind or batteries, they're always going to take half a gigawatt is a lot. Right. It's always going to take a long time to construct. We're really thinking of projects in 10 to 100 megawatts. So they have a smaller footprint, they lower hills, more site opportunities, but the power of the project is just small. So those three things together are how we expect to achieve that speed
right
through the consenting and the construction activities.
Is there not a fourth element, which is the biodiversity element, in the sense that like you guys are not having to rely on existing water sources, water courses, and therefore all of the ecosystems that depend on those water courses here in the UK where I'm sitting or other places, that might be a huge consideration from an environmental protection point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. The extraction of water from rivers and the returning it back into the rivers, it is a big issue on biodiversity, or the creation of lakes, flooding valleys. It is also a big issue for pumped hydro. And that's probably one of the main reasons why the consenting process takes so long. Absolutely, it is very much part of that sort of bigger picture. It's not only the footprint, but I was sort of alluding to that, where you have more choices of sites. So you could go, I don't need to be right next to this
right
pristine river, I mean, or up in this pristine valley. I can be somewhere else.
Would that also include like places that are non-traditionally thought of as places where you could do pumped hydro? So I've worked in Saudi, I've worked in Qatar, I've worked other places. So if like there are several hills, so the requirement for having the elevation necessary to be able to use the gravity to do the thing is much, much less, right? So
correct. Yes.
If I'm in Saudi, I'm in the empty desert, right? There's literally nothing there, except that I've got a hill that gives me 400 meters of elevation, but there's no water source nearby, but it's actually near where I'm going to do collecting a lot of solar. Then potentially that's like opening up all sorts of places where there's no natural water course where you guys could be. Is that right?
Perfect. Yeah, no, we absolutely love that idea. And we think cities that are in very arid conditions or industrial uses, the Middle East is a great example of that, but also in the southern United States, large parts of Australia, Chile that I've already mentioned, North Africa. When we first started looking at this, we did a small amount of analysis about our traditional pumped hydro in proximity to high rainfall. And the answer is this represented around 25% of the Earth's land mass.
Mm.
And 75% weren't really being addressed by traditional pumped hydro. So we see this as a huge margin opportunity. Now, obviously, you do get larger rivers running through arid places. Egypt's a good example with the Nile. And yes, you can do these things. But evaporation in those climates, which we carefully control through having covered storage tanks, we think it's a great opportunity. And we're not really affected by high temperatures, so the fluid doesn't care whether it gets to 70 right. degrees or something like that. So operating in high arid ambient temperatures, we don't have to cool it. We don't have cooling loads that you would with batteries in those sorts of conditions. And we're looking forward to those opportunities.
If you'd like to hear the full interviews with Stephen Crozer and Chris Adams, sign up at wickedproblems.earth and you'll get the whole conversation and not just the McNuggets. Ooh, McNuggets. Sorry, where was I? And now, we rejoin our panel discussion with Jonathan Leake of the Daily Telegraph and Ryan Chilcote, with host Richard Delavan.
So thanks for this discussion. It's been great. As we head off into closing, I wanted to ask if you have been watching any particular stories on your radar that you can let people who are listening in share in your joy or your despair about what you're actually checking out.
Just a quick one from me. All the attacks on energy infrastructure in Ukraine, the most recent ones, the attacks on the largest power plant outside of Kiev, a solar facility you were talking about hit. The Russians have been very consistent and very systematic in targeting energy facilities. And I just think this is an interest. I mean, and even, and it's another half or an hour long conversation who's behind it. But even at the beginning of the war, the targeting of the pipelines that were sending Russian gas into Western Europe,
Nord Stream,
those all got blown. Yeah, Nord Stream, those goals got blown up. This is an interesting trend to keep an eye on, and it's going to cause a lot of chaos in the future. And I guess I'm sure it's always been part of warfare, but we'll definitely be influencing warfare going forward. I just think it's worth pointing out because there's a lot of focus right now on human suffering because of the wars that we're seeing, and rightfully. But this is somehow sort of less dramatic on television screens for sure. And it might be like an even more effective way for countries fighting wars to pursue their objectives. Mm-hmm. And it is massively effective, but it sort of seems to be happening under the radar.
Jonathan, what are you keeping an eye on?
I think in the UK, the most immediate thing is the solar power industry, because the government is on the verge of publishing its solar roadmap, which is going to set out the course for solar across the UK in the coming decade, I guess. And the reason that's important is because, on the one hand, solar could be quite useful, not massive, but useful source of renewable energy. On the other hand, it has enormous political risk, because if you build solar farms in Britain, you're essentially going to want to build them in the south. And the south is, it's basically it's what's left of our green and pleasant land. And the proposal that's going to be in the solar roadmap is to cover I think it's 250,000 acres or something like that. And it's an area the size roughly of Middlesex. And that's just to begin with by 2035.
Wow.
Pretty much nowhere in Britain, in England, in southern England, which is the Conservative heartland, out of sight of a solar farm. And that's a transformation that's going to generate a lot of debate and a lot of resistance.
Debate and resistance, I think, that's a lovely understatement from the energy editor of the Telegraph. And where is this out of Desnes? I mean, where's this coming? Where's this solar roadmap going to be published from, Jonathan, just so we can keep an eye on it with yourself?
Desnes, Department for Energy Security and Net Zero. They've written it. It's been finished. They're waiting for that moment when they think they can publish it without possibly being noticed too much.
Could it possibly May 1st, maybe? Something else might happen the following day to, like, maybe take up some headlines, maybe? I don't know.
May the 2nd is going to be an essential, an important day after which a lot of reports will get published. Just today, the government was meant to be publishing the decision on Sunica Farm, which is Western Europe's biggest solar farm. Mm. Covering a huge area of Suffolk and Cambridgeshire near to the Mildenhall US Air Base. And it's very controversial, and it's just been shelved till June 20th.
Well, very interesting indeed. Look, I mean, for myself, I think I'm gonna stump for Polita Clark's FT piece that she wrote earlier this week on what happens when and if we get to a point where we actually start reporting a global decline in overall emissions. I mean, and Polita having spoken to a couple of different sources, but talking about the idea that this might have a kind of cascade effect on basically having people feel more comfortable in accelerating that trend, but that this could represent a real tipping point. She quotes a lot from Nat Keown, or Cohen, rather, the Obama White House advisor and now president of the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions think tank. So we'll put that in the show notes as well. But listen, thank you guys so much.
great talking. Thank you so much, Jonathan Leek, energy editor of the Daily Telegraph, for joining us.
Many thanks to you.
And thank you.
It was a pleasure.
And thank you, Ryan Chilcote, of the many parishes of the CNN, the Bloombergs, the CBSs, the PBS NewsHour, even Fox Business, or Fox News, I should say, occasionally, and with 33 comms in his other guise. So thank you both for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll talk again. I hope we can get you both back soon.
Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, we'd love to come back. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Wicked Problems, made possible through the generosity of people like you. If you liked this conversation, please share it and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like an ad-free version of this podcast, consider becoming a paid subscriber at wickedproblems.earth. You'll also get our newsletter, all our show notes, member-only goodies, and you'll be supporting media that wants to tell the stories at the frontier of climate tech, the place where people and politics, technology and capital meet and shape the future. And whether it's one you'd want to live in. Wicked Problems is written and edited by Richard Delavan. Production assistance was provided by me, Theodore Delavan. Wicked Problems, Climate Tech Conversations, is a production of Wicked Problems Limited. Thanks again for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.